listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly conversation continues with Professor Tony Montero in what may be our first conversation about the 2020 elections. Well, Professor Montero, I looked up today, first of all, remembering about 2 years ago when we went to the RNC and the DNC, looked up the information about the one coming in 2020. Now, 2020, we should be able to see clearly, right? And sorry for that. And, you know, I guess we've got one is in July and the other in August. They're more than a month apart. The Republicans are in Charlotte, was it? It's in North Carolina, somewhere in one of those states. And the Democrats have, I think, still three cities that they're deciding among, including, was it St. Louis or some one of the smaller Midwestern cities that they've never had it before. So anyway, the drama for the whole 2020 thing is starting to stir in the background to everything else we're going to talk about, which includes Trump at the wall today or whatever at the border, the Pelosi-Schumer press conference following up after Trump's presser the other night, every other crazy thing going on in the world. Pick a place and we'll start there.
Well, the 2020 election has already begun, and it will take place within the midst of the greatest political crisis in almost 160 years, and probably maybe the greatest political crisis in the history of the country. This will be the most unusual election, at least in modern times. It has all of the aspects of not just a great drama, but the fracturing of the political system itself. And I believe one, if not both, of the major political parties will disintegrate right before our very eyes. And now, you know, the Democrats, with about 25 people having announced or getting ready to announce, will probably show the greatest fracturing of either party. And we see already these factions, the young guard, so-called socialists, so-called progressives, versus the old guard, the Pelosis and the Schumers, and those connected most securely to the big money donors of the Democratic Party. I see this as a fight to the death within the Democratic Party. I think for the most part, the Republicans will remain not the Republican Party, but really the Trump Party. And so that's where it's going to be fought. It's going to get nasty. It's going to get ugly. And we can't rule out, if not a major recession, at least a mild recession, which will increase the sense of insecurity and uncertainty among the working people of the United States. So I look forward to this. It's going to bring to the fore all of the great contradictions that affect a late capitalist society like our own. And the ripples from it, of course, will affect the politics in all of the major capitalist countries.
You know, when you talk about this election taking place in the midst of a crisis like that, of that 160-year magnitude, I just did a quick lookup of the 1860 and 1864 elections. And there's some very curious things here that people, I've forgotten some of this just looking at the skin of it. You know, there were four candidates in 1860 when Abraham Lincoln was elected.
Yeah.
And he was elected with only 39.8% of the popular vote. There were two Democratic candidates. Stephen Douglas was a Northern Democrat, and John Breckinridge was a Southern Democrat. And between the two of them, they got about 2.2 million popular votes to Lincoln's 1.865 million popular votes. But because of the nature of the Electoral College and the relative populations, Lincoln had 180 electoral votes, and between them, Breckinridge and Douglas only had 84. And Douglas had only 12 electoral votes, even though he had 1.38 million popular votes. And Breckinridge had 72 electoral votes as opposed to 12. And he had only 848,000. In other words, he had two-thirds of the popular vote that Douglas had, and he had six times the number of electors. So that was in 1860. Then 4 years later, in the midst of the Civil War, it's only two candidates because the South was seceded, and it was closer. George McClellan got 45% of the popular vote, and Lincoln 55%. This is, you know, with the Civil War raging. So, you know, it was pretty interesting stuff.
Oh yeah. And we're facing a crisis of that magnitude again, and elections take on strange dynamics in the midst of political crises. Well, I don't know if we can predict the outcome. What we can predict is an intense struggle. The question is, what role will the masses of people play? Will they sit on the sideline and just observe this through CNN and podcasts and MSNBC and Fox, or will there be active organizing, for example, for peace in the sense of actual withdrawal from Syria, actual withdrawal from Afghanistan? Will there be a demand, for example, to cease shipment of military equipment to Israel? Will there be a discussion of a comprehensive immigration policy? And really, will the question of infrastructure development and a jobs and anti-poverty program find its way into the debate? I am hoping that in this period, this year or so before the 2020 election, that people begin to organize and hold town halls and other kinds of meetings on a grassroots level, that the unions begin to discuss the issues that confront the working class. I think this could present an opportunity for the grassroots, both in the labor movement and in the communities, to make their voices heard and through their actions and discussions to determine the directions of this election.
You know, that's a very good point. I'm looking at the claim of, Russian hand directing, not just a little Russian influence in the 2016 mm-hmm. election, but mm-hmm. Russia determined who our president is. That's mm-hmm. Not even subtext of all of these Russiagate claims. Mm-hmm. But the fact pattern it rests on is, tens of thousands of dollars of Facebook ads and whatever. Which is, is laughable compared to a $2 billion electoral budget and all the airtime that everybody got that had nothing mm-hmm. to do with Russia. The day before yesterday, I saw an article in the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, the same guy that owns Amazon, as we know. Mm-hmm. And it was a propaganda piece slandering China. The headline itself carried with it the implicit claim, I think the explicit claim, actually, that China has gulags for Muslims inside mm-hmm. China. And because I think that was the actual title of like China's gulags for Muslims or something. So it occurred to me, now you look at the last week, the week before, Apple utters that they might not sell as many iPhones, and the Dow plummets like 600-700 points. People look at like, oh my God, are the markets going to go into a free fall over mm-hmm. that? China, it occurred to me, and I posted something mischievously to my Facebook page about this, but it really started a conversation. I'm China, and Bezos is slandering me in the newspaper, clearly mm-hmm. attempting to meddle in my internal affairs in a way that is much more heavy-handed, and by the mm-hmm. way, with a much more heavy-handed tradition coming from the United States than mm-hmm. anything anybody could accuse anybody of inside doing to the United States. Mm-hmm. And that they're looking to establish a regime change with this propaganda. Well, mm-hmm. suppose, and now we have the Helms-Burton Act style mm-hmm. sanctions as a precedent now established mm-hmm. by the United States. If we wanted to throw an embargo around Cuba, not only do you have to stay away from Cuba, but you have to stay away from anybody that didn't stay away from Cuba, or you got to stay away from the whole world. Mm-hmm. Like, in other words, we can isolate you for doing business with somebody that does business with somebody we say you can't do business with. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking, okay, let's take those rules and even bring them in a generation closer to the vest. Let's say China decides, because Jeff Bezos is slandering us and looking in coordination with the U.S. to do regime change in our country, we're going to sanction Amazon. They cannot carry any product manufactured in China that's manufactured any place that's been financed by China, that is being sold and or wholesaled or transported or whatever by anybody that has anything to do with China, cannot sell to Amazon. Mm-hmm. Now, if this talk about the iPhones sent the markets into a dive because the sales were off by 10%, what would China saying and proving to the world, Amazon, you cannot sell any more Chinese goods or any goods that had any trade with China at all? That's like Amazon can't sell anything, in other words. It turns mm-hmm. into like a Soviet store in 1989 or something. mm-hmm. What do you think? Mm-hmm. What kind of power is that China could drop? You say you know, one of the influences on the election might be, you know, whatever is going on with the economy. Suppose China decided to drop that, like, in October of 2020, the kind of influence that they could have. And so when you're talking about the unrest in the country, you suddenly have a prospect of an inside-outside game.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a dangerous game. And because China, even with the slowdown, is, if not now, will in the next year or two be the largest economy in the world. The global economy will, in large measure, be dependent upon what happens in China. I think that the ruling class of the United States is without a vision and are desperate. The internal struggle within the ruling class, and actually, I think the more intense one is between the ruling class and the people. This struggle has driven a good part of the American elite mad, crazy. And that is a factor. And so what we have to prevent or hope to avoid is their doing something desperate, like a military confrontation with China or Russia. It is not insignificant that based upon Trump's announcement of withdrawing the 2,000 troops from Syria and 7,000 from Afghanistan and all of the implications of those withdrawals, that Mattis was fired and General Zinni just resigned from his position as ambassador to Qatar. I think it's Qatar. So now we have not only the FBI, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the other nine or so intelligence services of the United States in lockstep opposition to Trump, but increasingly the generals withdrawing from his administration and signing petitions or ads that say that he is making a mistake, that he's endangering American security, and on and on and on. These people are capable of doing desperate things in desperate times. And that is why the action of the people is so important. I would just put it that way. I hear what you're saying. There's hysteria from people like Bezos and probably others, but that's the situation that we face at this point. They begin to act as though the political crisis is in fact, as I have suggested, an existential crisis of the political system.
Here's another example of exactly that question in what has to be obvious meddling by the UK. This is the Guardian newspaper today. What is America going to do about its Trump problem in 2019? The subheading, removing Donald Trump is essential, but to fully address the work that needs to be done, his appointees must also step down. This is instructions from London, basically, to the American government. So it's going to be quite a pot being stirred.
Oh, no. I would not underestimate the critical nature of the situation that we're confronted with. You know, some people who have been generally progressive are making arguments that look like Bernie Sanders or Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, that the place that we must all go is to the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party must hear the voices of its so-called left wing. I think that is a losing strategy from the beginning. What we need is independent political action of the people that forces anybody that enters this race to respond to the demands of the people for peace and justice and economic prosperity, which means a poverty infrastructure program, a green ecological New Deal, but at the core, there must be peace and the cut in the military budget significantly. So any other discussion, I think, leads nowhere. It constitutes a capitulation to the ruling class and really to the most warlike elements of the ruling class who are presenting themselves as candidates of the people while still holding tightly to their position of war and endless wars abroad.
Yeah. I mean, in a condition of disintegration, of delegitimization, of chaos, you have the hardest push, the most belligerent foreign policy that perhaps imaginable being unleashed. And actually, that's the weapon that they want to use to smash what remains of the constitutional government in the country. Donald Trump is not fit to be the president, despite the fact that he was elected, because he's an agent of Russia. And therefore, we can, and the Russians are basically trying to do away with our constitutional system. So in order to protect ourselves against that, we have to disregard our constitutional system and remove Trump by any means necessary.
That's right. That's right. And this is the worst form of McCarthyism and Cold War propaganda. I mean, it is, it harkens back to the worst days of the 1950s. And for so-called liberals and progressives and even leftists to join that type of parade is, in fact, heresy, apostasy. It is a betrayal of all that they say they are supposed to be about. Now, that means that this period that we're entering into is going to have to also be contain an ideological and political struggle within the left and progressive forces. And the truth must prevail. There cannot be this hiding behind the Democrats should do X, Y, and Z. Well, let's be real. The Democrats are not going to do anything but what they have done in the past. It remains the party of the neocons and the neoliberals, more so now than in 2016. I mean, let's get it real. It is the party of war. And all of the generals, all of the deep state operatives that abandoned the Republicans and Trump are now in the Democratic Party. That's the big tent.
And I remember the, was it the 2012 election? When they, in essence, announced the death of the Republican Party. It might have even been first in 2008 because the Democrats had recaptured both houses of Congress, and then Obama was elected president. And they retained or expanded for the first, for the year 2008, the majorities in the House and Senate. Now you have people writing about Trump was able to find a path to the White House through the remains of the Republican Party, the debris of it, and that, in other words, that this condition did exist, the Republican Party was finished, and, you know, out of the ashes comes Donald Trump. Well, you know, they're saying the same thing about the Democratic Party now, and they seem hell-bent on, you know, as they mobilize, you know, the most right-wing reactionary forces and express them through the Democratic Party, what one thing that they're doing is creating the same kind of condition that the Republicans did when they had the most, you know, backwards, you know, right-wing Christian maniacs spewing in 2012, that some new voice that actually talks some sense might get the support of the constituency. What do you see in terms of that?
Well, see, I think it's hard to compare 2012 to 2020 or even 2016. Yeah. I mean, we're in the throes of a crisis the likes of which has not been seen in this country for almost 160 years. I mean, and that is the backdrop to everything. Now, of course, at the same time, the global economy is slowing down. How deep the recession that is coming will be, no one can fully predict. I know one thing, the stock markets are very jittery. That can tell you something about how the financial oligarchs and elites look upon the future. But that having been said, the deepest crisis is in the political system. And when you look at polling about people's attitudes towards the press, towards the Congress, towards almost every major institution of the country, they show very low approval ratings by the people. I mean, in the 20s and below. That is what we call, and I've said this before, a legitimation crisis. And it is made even worse by the fact that the center has collapsed. The vital center has collapsed. And people like Richard Haass of the Foreign, the Council on Foreign Relations is now talking about how to manage the dismemberment of the American empire, how to manage it. And if he's talking about it here, you know, in Germany and France and England and throughout Europe, elites are also discussing that as well. And perhaps the crisis is worse in Europe because the single currency, the euro, might be abandoned by country after country. And if that happens, then you're looking at a whole new political and economic situation in Europe. The other side of it is, with all of the attacks upon Russia, with all of the sanctions upon Russia, Russia remains stable. And in a lot of ways, Putin and his government can show certain victories, especially in Syria. That is not insignificant. And that is what really bothers a lot of the U.S. elites. The other question is what happens in Ukraine, what and how will the Chinese-Russia strategic alliance go forward? And finally, I would say, what will happen on the Korean Peninsula? This is highly significant. I think the world is trending towards a new configuration where the United States will no longer be, and I think Trump is signaling this, will no longer seek hegemony. The multipolar world is being born out of the ruins of this unipolar world, a situation of 30 years. We don't know what will become of Europe as a whole, but we do know that things look better on the Asian continent than it does in Europe or North America.
Yeah, I mean, I think the competing visions, to use some sort of symbolic language, would be that the existing hegemonic drive and project, you know, would be that the United States is the king of the world, and Trump sees maybe the United States being like the boss of all bosses. You know, like first among equal, you know, something like that. In other words, more it's a more of a collegial, form of domination.
Well, one would hope so. One would hope so.
Well, it seems like that's a multipolarity. In other words, that would be the symbolic representation of multipolarity as opposed to the hegemony.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So that now you have like that struggle that's driving a lot of this. That's mm-hmm. the foundation of a lot of this. You have, the intense contradictions just generally in terms of the crisis of legitimacy that you talk about, the continuing austerity, the hollowing out mm-hmm. of things. You have a contradiction also shaping up or becoming remanifest maybe between the real economy and the mm-hmm. financialized economy, mm-hmm. where you might see like the markets look terrible and maybe interest rates not be favorable, but people having jobs and things, and so the economy itself, being better for the people that are going to go vote. Like, yeah, interest rates are terrible, but I got a job and I just had a turkey, and so we're going to vote for you. Then that's kind of weird, but you've got things like the Atlantic, for example. Colleges are no match for American poverty. All of the things that people expected before are, like, mm-hmm. way out of reach now. Now, all of that mixes into to this.
Yeah, you have to include it all. You have to do a holistic analysis, as they in sociology says, a multivariate analysis.
Right.
you know, and there are so many factors that you literally do need computer programs to kind of predict outcomes based upon how you weigh the various factors, the political crisis versus the world economy, or how they, not versus, but how they interact. So, but then, you know, still, I am convinced that it is people who make history. And so much depends on what the masses of people do. It seems that Trump will be very, very difficult to beat in 2020. But of course, the struggle might be over holding on to the House and taking back the Senate. And then going forward with some form of impeachment if he wins, and maybe even a coup d'etat. And you cannot rule out a desperate act of warfare taken without Trump by forces in the military. You know, there's so much in, that could happen in a crisis like this. But the key is to educate the masses, to prepare the people for whatever comes, and to help them to see what's going on and then to organize in their class interest.
And that is always the trick, isn't it, Tony?
Yeah,
thank
that's
you
the
very
trick,
much.
Always.
I'll speak with you again next week. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that was the world-renowned Du Boisian scholar from Philadelphia, Professor Anthony Montero. He's featured here weekly, and he came to us via Skype from Philadelphia Thursday. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Thucydides trap goes something like this. When one great power threatens to displace another, war is almost always the result. But it doesn't have to be. How does this apply to the current tension surrounding the U.S.-China bilateral relationship? Are both countries trapped into a deadly spiral? Crosstalking the Thucydides trap, I'm joined by my guest Seth Cropsey in Washington. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and director of Hudson Center for American Sea Power. And in Santa Cruz, we cross to James Bradley. He is a New York Times number one best-selling author. His latest book is The China Mirage. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Seth. You know, Seth, and I usually don't get to use my graduate school experience of many years ago. I did read Thucydides, and what he said, this is more than 2,400 years ago, it was the rise of Athens and the fear that it inspired in Sparta that made war inevitable. And the Thucydides trap now is being bandied about when we consider the U.S.-China bilateral relationship. Are we? Do we have another Athens and Sparta in play in the 21st century? Seth in Washington.
I don't think so, Peter. It's possible, but... The relationship between China and the United States has many elements to it, and the one that we're focused on most these days is the commercial aspect, but there's also a military element. So I think a lot of the commercial problems can be resolved, especially if China understands its interest in participating more fully in the sort of the international world order, world system. The military one is more problematic because it China's attempt to deny access to the American fleet in the West Pacific is an issue between the United States and China because of our allies in the West Pacific, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, our partners, Taiwan. So that's more problematic.
Okay, James, how about you? Because we have a rising power, and that the status quo power, the United States, sees the rise of China, or the return of China, as the Chinese would say, as a growing threat. The problem is here, kind of reflecting upon what Seth had to say, is that I guess it's a question if China wants to play by Washington's rules. But at a certain point, why would China do that if it has the assets and the resources to challenge that? I think that's the crux of this entire discussion. Go ahead, James.
Well, Dr. Graham Allison, as you know, is the one who coined this term, the Thucydides trap. And the trap is that 16 situations were studied when a secondary power was challenging the first power, and 12 of them failed, but that means 4 succeeded. And the good news is that the United States was part of 3 of those 4. With the rise of the United States at end of the 19th century, the UK and the US worked it out. With Russia, we had a Cold War. We didn't have a fighting war. There were no nukes dropped. We didn't attack each other. And then with the rise of Germany, we've entangled Germany with NATO and the EU to keep that under wraps. So 3 of his examples involved the United States. 3 were successful. I agree with Seth regarding the military challenges there, but I think it would help the United States to view China not as a surprising rising power, but as the country that was the dominant power in most of human history, and it's just resuming its leadership role.
Okay, Seth, reflect upon that, because as I said, you know, the return of China, because that's how the Chinese see it. They do not want to be a junior partner in a Western-led club. I think that's quite obvious now. Is that going to be problematic in terms of the military, the issue that you brought up?
No, I think it really depends upon what China's goals with its military are. If they want to control if they want to become the military hegemon of Asia, that puts us on a collision course with them, because the United States has been a Pacific power going back to the 19th century. And regardless of that, the fact is that we have important allies from Australia to Japan, with whom we have commercial and military relationships that are not intended to threaten China. They haven't threatened China in the past. In fact, China has benefited from the generally benign atmosphere that's been produced by American military presence in the Pacific. If China wants to threaten that, then we have an issue, but that's not necessary.
Okay, you know, James,
it's not inevitable.
Okay, James, at the beginning of at the very end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, the United States told European powers to stay out of the Western Hemisphere. And they could do it because they had the assets to do it, and they had the motivation to do it. Now, why should, and I'm just being the devil's advocate here, why should China obey American rules? Why does it have to say, you decide who can go where in different parts of the Pacific? I mean, again, trying to take the point of view or look from the gaze of Beijing, why should they have to be held accountable to rules and perceptions of the world order that the United States determine? Go ahead, James.
Well, I think Beijing would look at this in a multi-hundred-year view. And what has come up from the South China Sea? What has been the naval problem in the South China Sea? From Beijing's point of view, it was the British coming up and stealing Hong Kong and 100 years of shame for China. The French Navy came up and destroyed the Summer Palace. John McCain was flying off a U.S. naval aircraft carrier, and 3 million Asians died. So China does not have the bad record in the South China Sea. I'm talking to you from the Canary Islands off the coast of Africa. These are Spanish. They're not very close to Spain. At one time, the Spanish Empire was expanding, and they grabbed these islands. The United States, what is the United States doing in Guam? How did we get Hawaii? we got these assets in the Pacific by putting bayonets up to the leaders of those islands and saying, you're American now. So China is an expanding empire. They look at the South China Sea as their backyard. They want it for their security. And if the United States doesn't like that, I think the United States should maybe allow China to have power in the Caribbean, let's say. What if there were Chinese ships going between Florida and Cuba or off the San Francisco coast? We wouldn't allow it. No rising power is going to allow this. And there's no reason that the U.S. Navy has to continue its incursions there.
Seth, when I looked
I'm not so.
Go ahead, Seth, jump in. That's the point of the program. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. The issue is not the imposition of an American-based order. The idea of international waters and the freedom of navigation in them is not simply an American construct. It's subscribed to by most of the rest of the world, including China, which is a signatory to the Law of the Sea Treaty. But China is claiming the international waters of the South China Sea as territorial waters and trying to enforce that claim by military means. If Chinese ships want to travel in the Caribbean's international waters, I don't think the United States is going to do anything about it.
But I don't think they would like it, Seth. Would you? I think that would be the assumption.
There's a difference between not liking it and using force to prevent it.
Well, I mean, again, at the turn of the century, 20th century, the U.S. threatened to use force against European powers that wanted to, quote-unquote, meddle in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, why can't the Chinese say, well, we'll have our own Monroe Doctrine, and this is our sphere of influence. We'll stay out of yours, you stay out of ours. That's a grand bargain. But that would be making a concession, wouldn't it? And that's something the U.S. doesn't want to do. Go ahead, Seth.
Right, but the Monroe Doctrine in no way forbids foreign ships from traveling from transiting international waters.
Well, in the early 20th century, the U.S. made it very clear. It made it very clear that the European powers could not be bringing their warships to Latin America. They made it very, very clear. I read up on it right before we came to the program here, James. Grand bargain, a grand bargain would be equals, and that's the U.S. will never allow itself to see China as an equal. James.
Well, I think, in the question before you asked me to take Beijing's side, to answer this question, I'll take Washington's side and Beijing's side.
Okay.
Washington has traditionally had a missionary attitude towards Asia, and, the other is inferior and needs American help. Again, we're not talking about young, feeble China, a poor country that's rising up for the first time. We're talking about history's world leader of humanity resuming that role. And I think the view from Beijing is of the scholar. And let's look at historical facts. Let's look at how America and Britain got out to the Pacific. What was their behavior like? I mean, Diego Garcia, the British and the United and Americans just wiped humans off after we shot their dogs first. So expanding, wanting some elbow room with vital waters, I think is a legitimate interest of China.
All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Thucydides trap. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Seth in Washington. We could look at the Thucydides trap and we can kind of maybe extrapolate from it. And I think history, and James already brought up the 16 examples that Graham Allison suggested in his seminal article on the Thucydides trap. Seth, when a rising power challenges in one form or another or across the board a dominant power, there's three things that can happen. One, the dominant power can allow it to happen. And there may be some reasons in certain cases they allow that to happen. Second one is you negotiate. You negotiate the rise where the international system remains stable. And then the third, you don't allow it and you resort to military force. Let's focus on the second one here. What kind of compromise do you think Washington would accept and Beijing accept? Because they have a lot of mutual interests here. Go ahead, Seth, in Washington.
Well, the compromise that you're talking about, Peter, is something that would play out over decades.
Okay.
So it's difficult to say, but I think generally speaking, the United States seeks in the future what it has in the past, which is that China think of itself as a stakeholder in the international system. If that means compromising, then that's the kind of compromising that would avoid friction and greater tension between the two large countries. If China wants to set out on its own, and everything in its dealings with other nations, from commercial to military, comes with Chinese characteristics, then there's a problem. It's not only a problem for the United States, it's a problem for the rest of the world that sees value in an international system that respects sovereignty, freedom of navigation, the idea that force isn't used to gain other people's territory, the whole large set of ideas and principles that has kept the world relatively stable since the end of World War II.
Okay. Well, James, given the rules of engagement in the international order, if I were sitting in Beijing and considering what Seth just said about sovereignty, what about the sovereignty of Iraq, of Afghanistan, of Libya, of Syria, of Yemen? I mean, what are the rules of the international order if you're sitting in Beijing and you're watching the hegemon say, you play by the rules, but we don't have to? This is what irritates the Chinese a lot. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, I don't understand the idea that the United States following the international order has been peaceful at all. I mean, I've been living in Asia, 3 million dead when the U.S. Navy entered the South China Sea. The problem here is we're hitting a nail with a hammer. Obama was told, hey, the Chinese are rising. So he went to the lever that he could, which was the military, and he pivoted the military over to China as some sort of solution. And now we're going to keep China bottled in the South China Sea and maybe cause some havoc in the stands and with Iran and interrupt the new Silk Road. I mean, there's got to be a better way. And again, the Thucydides trap said that there were four successful examples where war didn't happen, and the United States was part of three. But, when Eisenhower turned over the presidency to JFK, he said, your number one foreign policy problem is Laos. Well, we had no Laotian contacts. We didn't know the language. We didn't have classes in university on Laos. So Kennedy went to the only available lever, which was the military. I mean, we did not talk to China for almost 30 years. The contacts between the United States and China in a commercial sense are very strong, but in terms of a diplomatic sense are weak. And we should be leading with talking and not with the military. And I think China has a very, very good historical reason to be concerned about the U.S. military.
Okay, Seth, when China was brought into the World Trade Organization, and I remember this very well, and I'm sure you do too, is that, the Chinese will join, they'll play by our rules, and again, Americans have this really bad habit that they think everyone in the world wants to be like them, but that's not really true. The Chinese don't want to be Americans. They don't hold American values. They have a different history, a different culture, And this is what's causing the problem here, because the Chinese won't play by our rules, but the Chinese would say, well, every rising power and dominant power determines the nature of the international order. Now, if China is going to be equal exceed the United States in some areas like the size of the economy, maybe in areas of technology, why would it settle to be a junior partner when it can say, we want to do what you do? Go ahead, Seth.
I don't think that the American policy is aiming toward making China a junior partner in anything. I think the United States would like to see this issue between the two countries resolved amicably. I don't think, though, that that includes things, for example, like the theft of intellectual property and the resulting commercial disadvantage that that puts the United States at in relative to China. And I don't think that turning a discussion such as this one into a question of U.S. behavior or misbehavior in the past advances the question that you're trying to answer here, which is how do we proceed forward? What sort of order will exist in the international sphere? Is that of any use? Who benefits from that? And how is it to be continued? And when I say international order, I don't mean something that's imposed by the United States. It's something that is agreed to by most of the nations of the world, and to which benefit from it.
Okay, James.
Can I respond?
Go ahead, James. That's the point of the program.
No one was turning it into an examination of the past. You were asking me how Beijing might look at this. And I'm just saying that Americans are a little out of touch with China. I mean, Tim Cook just said that the macroeconomic pressures he was surprised by, iPhone sales down in China. Have you been in, I've been all over Asia. I've seen kids who love their iPhones 5-10 years ago. They're all buying the Huawei thing or the Oppo phone. I mean, better pictures and they're just fantastic. Tim Cook should realize that China's just doing a better job. I'm just suggesting that the United States does not look at just the last 2 weeks or the last 4 months or the last 100 years, because the Chinese don't. I mean, go over to Guangzhou.
No, that's not
huge monuments to the.
That's not the problem with the Apple product.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, that's not the problem with the Apple product.
We should widen our view.
Okay, Seth, jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah. That's not the problem with the Apple product in China. The problem is that the users get younger and younger, or as the group of users becomes younger and younger, they don't need phones that are as user-friendly as the Apple product is. So, for example, the other day I bought an iPhone where my son uses a Google. Or a Samsung, and he warned me it's more complicated to use that. And I said, I want something simpler. And I think that's the case in China as well, and that's one of the problems that Apple has.
Well, Huawei just makes
it essentially makes the same
phone, and it's cheaper, okay? And that's called market economy, okay? And it's as simple as that. James, we're almost out of time here. The Chinese have repeatedly said that the United States is attempting to contain it. How would you think? Would you agree with that assessment from the Chinese?
Of course. Just look at a map. I mean, my good friend John Pilger did a wonderful documentary on the coming war with China. Just look at the maps that he produces of all the American arms surrounding China. I mean, it's containment.
And what is it? What is the implications? How are the Chinese react to that? Would they want to break out of that containment?
Nobody likes that. China wants some elbow room. The United States got its elbow room in the past. And I'm not arguing that it's correct or that I agree with it. I'm just saying that this is what is happening and is going to continue to happen.
Okay, Seth, you wanted to jump in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. The American military positions overseas in Asia are a result of the end of World War II, the rise of communism and its aggression in the Far East, and the alliances that were the United States negotiated at the request of its allies in Asia, again, from Australia to Japan. Those countries fear Chinese hegemony. They evidently, as their alliances with the United States demonstrate, do not fear the United States, are not worried that the United States will try to impose some kind of order on them, and are democratic. It's a democratic ring that surrounds China. That was not done in order to threaten China. That was done because the people of those countries wanted to be democracies.
James, you want to react to that? Go ahead. 40 seconds to you, James.
I would just say that all these lines were drawn after World War II. There really was no Japan government, Japanese government. The United States military was running it. There was no effective Chinese government. There was a civil war going on when the United States gave Taiwan to Chiang Kai-shek. So the United States unilaterally drew a lot of the lines that now we're arguing are long-term, centuries-old international agreement or something. I'm not saying someone's right or wrong. I'm saying China now is getting up to the table and would like to negotiate.
Okay.
They're looking for a peaceful rise.
We ended on a positive note. Thank you, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Santa Cruz. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.